We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
All right, so we are just days away from local and national elections.
Yes, we are. And it's important that people not forget to vote. And you can still register in person if you're not registered through Election Day. To register in person, the easiest place for folks in Seattle to go is Lumen Fields Visitor Center. It's going to be open for voter registration on 3 days this weekend. They'll be open on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., on Monday, November 7th from 8:30 to 6, and on Election Day itself from 8:30 a.m. to 8 p.m. That's down on South Royal Brougham Way. Now, you can check out our previous coverage last week and the week before on our website at kodxseattle.org, where we talked about the candidates a couple weeks ago. And then last week we talked about the financing for each candidate and gave some of our endorsements. Also, you know, I noticed Erica Barnett had some great interviews with the different candidates that she's been printing on her blog this past week or so.
Election. She does that every election. It's very good.
And her blog is publicola.com. So check those out too if you want to.
Hacks and Wonks has a good, has been doing good coverage too for the election if you want to check out any of their shows that we've been airing on Thursdays.
Yeah. So there's some good content out there if you have any questions about the different candidates.
I like to talk in particular about three candidates in the local races that are alarmingly radical and are trying their best to whitewash that, literally whitewash that. Let's start with the Senate race between Patty Murray and Tiffany Smiley. Smiley is running as, you know, Patty Murray is responsible for a crime wave and inflation and blah, blah, blah. She doesn't even mention in the ads that she's a Republican. She's a smiling mom. And as I mentioned last week, I've been critical of Patty Murray for a number of years, and there's good reason for that. And there's polling out this week that shows that Smiley is way too close to Murray. And the problem with Murray, she's been in the Senate now for 30 years. She went there as her original political career was, I'm an outsider and I'm going to shake things up. That's how she got to the state legislature. That's how she sort of landed in the U.S. Senate. The problem is that she really doesn't have any signature issues that she has championed. She very rarely does legislation on her own. You know, the issues that she does champion are very politically safe issues like funding for veterans, which, you know, used to be a bipartisan thing until Republicans decided that this year that funding veterans benefits or veterans health care was a bad thing because Joe Biden would be signing it. So, but it used to be bipartisan. It used to be a very safe thing to do. The thing is that Murray has really focused most of her time and energy on becoming an insider, which is what she originally ran against. She is the consummate DC insider, valued within the party and the party leadership because she raises a lot of money for the party and for party candidates. And she raises most of that from corporate America. This is the problem. You know, so Murray is part of the DC problem. That said, Tiffany Smiley would like to ban all abortions, no exceptions for rape or incest. She would like to, she would certainly vote along with the rest of her party to, not raise the debt ceiling and thereby enable the U.S. to default on its, debts, which could cause a global economic, downturn at best. It's incredibly, she is full MAGA. She denies the legitimacy of the 2020 election. And she doesn't like to talk about any of that on the, in her TV ads because, you know, people wouldn't vote for her. So instead she talks about, you know, how wonderful her family is and how awful inflation is. Gosh, look at these foods. They cost so much. Now, the Congress really can't do a whole lot about that. That's the responsibility of price gouging corporations and the federal apparatus that isn't prosecuting for them for that and is continuing to allow mega mergers and things like the food industries.
And that would not change with Republicans in power, for sure. And in fact, the Republican platform is to lower taxes on corporations and wealthy individuals, which keep taxes in place or possibly raise them on people in the middle and lower income tiers. And that, if anything, would make inflation worse.
Yeah, let them eat $30 cakes.
yeah.
Pretty much. So that's the Senate race. And, the Senate right now is in the balance. It's 50-50. And then Kamala Harris breaks the tie. It could go either way. The Republicans could win it by one seat. The Democrats could win it by one seat. So it's sort of a cliche to say that if Smiley won in Washington State, Republicans would control the Senate. But if she wins here, it's likely because Republicans are winning in a lot of places. So it's a worrisome race, and it's worrisome because Smiley is completely unqualified to be in the Senate.
And I know I've talked about this before, but it really looks in that race like there's some age discrimination going on. It looks to me like a lot of voters are saying, hey, we're tired of Patty Murray. She's older. She's the establishment. Let's get some fresh blood in there. Let's vote for this younger person. And a lot of the folks who are supporting Smiley are men versus women. So
because Smiley is more attractive, quote unquote.
Yeah. So I think it's really coming down to to women voters and men who support women and women's rights to say, hey, no, we're not going to stand for having Tiffany Smiley represent us in DC.
Yeah. But if Smiley does well, there's a job waiting for her at Fox News because she's a prototypical Fox News blonde and she's just as vacuous as most of them. It's weird how all these conservative women are, young and perky and blonde. Mm-hmm, I just don't understand. So that's the Senate race. And I want to talk about a couple of the House races, the U.S. House of Representatives, because that also is going to be very tight as to whether Democrats can retain control of it. In the 8th District on the east side and going out into Kittitas County, is the Kim Shire, who unseated Dave Reichert a couple of election cycles ago. When he retired, is facing a serious challenge from the most radical of the Republicans in the primary, a guy named Matt Larkin, who, again, is an election denier, again, would ban all abortions, down the line. He is full, total MAGA. And he is not qualified to hold any elected office, let alone U.S. Congress. And he has a real chance of winning. If you're on the east side, if you're anywhere in this area, get out and vote, because your vote will matter. Finally, I want to talk about the 3rd District in Southwest Washington, that one between MAGA candidate Joe Kent and I'm going to mispronounce her name. Glutenkamp? Glusenkamp.
No, Glusenkamp.
Glusenkamp Perez. it's easier to remember it as Glutenkamp.
no, it's Glusenkamp.
It is Glusenkamp, however, just for the record. Glusenkamp Perez. And this is a Democrat who stands a real chance of taking over what was formerly a Republican-held district. Joe Kent defeated the incumbent in the primary, and he is full MAGA. There's serious questioning about who exactly has been paying for his salary, because the company he claims to work for doesn't exist. He then said, "Oh, I got it wrong, you know, dozens of times. It's this," and it turns out to be a shell company where the funding is not clear. And he again is full MAGA, election denier, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Washington State has a serious risk of electing four or five, totally radical, totally unqualified, totally willing to, join the fascist revolution, basically, in Congress. So, it is up to voters to keep them out. And that's what's at stake next Tuesday. We'll talk about national races in a little bit.
Yeah. Now, I also want to mention for folks in Seattle who are voting that I noticed this week that the Seattle Times editorial board completely misunderstood the Seattle ballot measure Prop 1A and 1B, and they recommended – the Times editorial board recommended that voters choose no on question one and then skip question two. And that's the opposite of what I'm recommending. Regardless of how you vote on question one, make sure you also vote for one of the two options in question two, even if you vote no on question one. But if you don't answer question two, then you're giving up your ability to help select an option if the majority of voters vote yes on question one. So make sure you don't give up your right to choose, all right? And I'm recommending, or, I'm saying that it's perfectly okay to vote yes on question one and then select Prop 1B for ranked choice voting as the progressive option on question two. But even if you vote no on question one, make sure you make a choice on question two. Otherwise, you're giving up your right to help decide that.
So yeah, absolutely.
I was kind of surprised. I didn't expect the Seattle Times to make that mistake. But then again, they're the Seattle Times.
I think a lot of people will make that mistake.
Yeah.
And, it is a confusing ballot measure for sure. Or set of ballot measures, I should say. But yes, that was my choice as well.
Yeah. So that wraps up the election, coverage. Again, if you want to know who we like in different races, particularly the races within the city of Seattle that have two Democrats in them, you can listen to our show last week by going to the website I talked about the campaign financing, where each of the candidates got their money from. And then the week prior to that, I talked about the issues with the candidates. Also, check out some of those resources we mentioned earlier, Publicola and Hacks and Wonks.
Or you could just check the Seattle Times editorial endorsements and then vote opposite.
Oh, no. I mean, they agree with us on some candidates, but not on others. So definitely do your own research and decide who you like.
Oh, God. Do your own research has been permanently poisoned as a phrase, I'm afraid.
Yeah, true.
Although it really does apply for elections.
For when you vote, yeah.
Don't take anybody else's word for it. Go to candidates' websites. Go to independent, things like Publicola, where Barnett has been interviewing candidates and getting really revealing answers out of them. She's very good at that. There's a lot of resources out there, so go use them.
So, returning to the subject of the Seattle City budget, they had some, I don't know if it was completely unexpected, but definitely some revenue issues this week.
Not the best news. The city council got the updated November revenue forecast for 2023 and 2024 this week, and it turned out to be worse than expected. The new update is showing a further $64 million decrease in expected REIT taxes. That's the real estate excise tax, which helps to fund capital improvements and infrastructure projects. It also showed a further $4.5 million decrease in the sweetened beverage tax revenue, which funds food programs. Overall, these decreases are expected to put a further $9.4 million hole in the general fund budget. Now, Teresa Mosqueda, yeah?
I should point out that, you know, that was the purpose of the sweetened beverage tax, was to reduce consumption of sweet things like Coke and Pepsi.
Yeah.
So that's true. That's good news in terms of the overall goal of the tax, but bad news in terms of revenue.
Yeah, it's a progressive tax, but it's not a stable tax. So it doesn't lead to stable revenues for the city. Now, Teresa Mosqueda, who's chair of the council's budget committee, announced a couple of changes because of this new revenue forecast. Instead of releasing her balancing package this coming Monday as scheduled, she's going to take an extra week to try and find ways to fill that gap in the budget, and is going to release the balancing package on Monday, November 14th instead. Now, the balancing package will include as many of the other council members' amendments as can be fit into the budget. And it's expected to have some big changes from Mayor Harrell's original proposal. And some of those changes include a full cost of living wage increase for service providers, which would be in line with inflation, unlike Mayor Harrell's proposal of an increase that would cover only half of the inflation rate, which would have meant a pay cut for human service workers. It'll include keeping the parking enforcement officers in the Department of Transportation instead of moving them back to the Seattle Police Department, as Harrell originally proposed.
Remember when those service workers were being hailed as frontline heroes during the pandemic at the beginning? Yeah, that's been forgotten by Mayor Harrell.
Yeah. It'll also include additional funding for the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, including a reduction to Mayor Harrell's proposal to expand the city's unified care team and instead it would move that some of that funding over to the Regional Homelessness Authority, really where it belongs. And then it should include additional funding for the lead and co-lead diversion programs and a whole lot more changes. Now, by taking an extra week to craft the balancing package, the council is moving the whole timeline for finishing the budget. So they'll begin voting on parts of the budget on November 21st, with the goal of voting on the final package on Monday, November 28th, which is the Monday after Thanksgiving. And they usually finish the budget the Monday before the holiday. Mosqueda has mentioned in the past that other cities take months to draft their budgets, not the 6 to 8 weeks that the city council does here in Seattle. And she's spoken wistfully about what the council might do in the future to try and change that timeline to give themselves more time to put together a better budget and to get feedback from the public while they're doing that, so that there's not such a compressed timeline. I think that might mean changes to the city charter, and that could take some time to do. Now, this time around, Mosqueda's mentioned the Seattle Revenue Stabilization Work Group, which is looking for new progressive sources of revenue for the city, and she said that they'll have some proposals ready by the middle of next year. That's about the time the council will start to work on updates on the two-year budget, usually about midway, maybe a little more than midway through the first year of a two-year budget. The council starts to get a feel for the actual revenue coming into the city's coffers so they can make tweaks and adjustments to the budget based on that feedback. Mosqueda is saying that if there's a bigger shortfall than expected partway through next year, then the council might take input from the Revenue Stabilization Work Group, and then they might pass another bill or two to enact new progressive taxes next year. So we're just going to have to wait and see what those recommendations might be and whether the council does that. This year, there are two new revenue sources proposed by council members as part of the budget for the Seattle Transportation Department. Andrew Lewis proposed a new tax on micro-mobility companies that provide electric scooters and bikes around the city. The tax would be 25 cents per trip, with the revenue earmarked for protected bike lanes, traffic calming, and Vision Zero pedestrian safety projects. And Alex Peterson proposed an increase to the city's vehicle license fee of about $10, which would take it from $40 up to $50. That revenue would be earmarked for bridge and overpass maintenance and Vision Zero pedestrian safety improvements. So the city council could decide to increase those two revenue sources above those proposals by Lewis and Peterson. Or I think what's more likely is they would adopt those two proposals and then do a one-time draw from either the Jumpstart tax fund to plug the hole in the budget, or they might combine it with a draw from the city's two reserve funds. Mayor Harrell's budget proposal moves several million dollars into the reserve funds to top them up. The council may decide that this is the time to be using those reserve funds, not setting more aside and forcing the city to accept an austerity budget. And then I also want to point you to a great resource for the city budget. I should have mentioned this before, the Seattle Solidarity Budget, which you can find at www.seattlesolidaritybudget.com. It's a resource.
Also, Shama Sawan is doing her people's budget. She's, I believe, on the 6th, on today, holding a city hall. You know, they do this every year where she solicits ideas from the community and then tries to incorporate them in the budget.
Yeah. And the Seattle Solidarity Budget is endorsed by a number of social justice groups, including groups like the Black Brilliance Research Project, Real Change, the Transit Writers Union, the Seattle Artists Coalition for Equitable Development, Sustainable Seattle, the Community Alliance for Global Justice, the Duwamish Tribe of Indians, Choose 180, Decriminalize Seattle, and many, many, many other groups. So it's a great place to start. And then if you want to take part in a public forum, you can go down and be part of the people's budget as well.
And, you know, I have an idea on funding the bike lines in terms of a revenue source. Can we fine the users of bicycles and scooters that the city is putting out there when they are left, like, across sidewalks or across sidewalk cuts so it gets in the way of wheelchairs? You know, it's...
Which I'm still seeing every day in my neighborhood, yeah.
Yeah. It's a very common thing.
Yeah, I would tax the companies on that one.
Yeah.
Because the companies have promised that they would educate users so that they wouldn't do that.
Well, it's not happening.
I mean,
purely anecdotal experience, but it doesn't seem like it's happening.
Yeah.
How about redistricting?
Oh, yes. Boy. The Seattle Redistricting Commission, a while back, released their first draft of a new map for revised city council districts based on the 2020 census. The 2020 census showed that a couple of districts had grown more than the others, namely districts 3 and 7. District 3 is Capitol Hill and First Hill. District 7 is downtown, Belltown, South Lake Union, Queen Anne, and Magnolia.
That's a direct result of increased density and all the new apartment buildings going up.
Absolutely. So new district boundaries had to be drawn to make sure that there would be about 105,000 people in each of the 7 geographic districts. After releasing that first draft back earlier this year, the commission held several public meetings and took testimony from neighborhood residents and community groups, including a group called Redistricting Justice for Seattle, which proposed some changes to the map that would keep from splitting up neighborhoods that contain a lot of renters and lower income folks, especially in District 7 and Districts 2 and 3. So the commission made some changes, and along each step of the way, they've released new drafts throughout the summer, each draft incorporating a new set of changes. with the most recent draft released on October 31st. The wealthier homeowners in Magnolia looked at that most recent map, and they were very unhappy with this new, with the latest map, because instead of splitting up neighborhoods with a lot of renters like South Lake Union or Lower Queen Anne or the International District, it now splits Magnolia along 28th Avenue West and moves the western portion out of District 7 and into District 6. Now, some of the other changes from the current district boundaries include in District 1, which is Lisa Herbold's district in West Seattle, it will expand eastward to pick up Soto and Georgetown from District 2. Then District 2, which is Tammy Morales' district in southeast Seattle, will pick up a chunk of the southern portion of District 3. That would be, I think, North Mount Baker neighborhood.
Yeah, it's with like Judkins Park, that area.
Yeah, with I-90 as the new dividing line. And then District 2 will also pick up the remainder of the Yesler Terrace neighborhood and will have all of the International District so that the ID won't be split in half anymore.
Yeah, a lot of the construction for Yesler Terrace is nearing completion. It is a cluster of, you know, garish large apartment buildings. That are not designed for low income.
That's all going to be in District 2 now. District 3, which is Shama Sawant's district, Capitol Hill and First Hill, in the north end, it's going to lose a small chunk to District 4, and that chunk is the western half of the Roanoke Peninsula that faces on Lake Union. And I think that there are a lot of expensive view homes along there, primarily condos and townhomes. That's going into District 4.
Yeah.
And then District 5 up in North Seattle, that's Deborah Juarez's district, it's going to pick up a chunk from the northern end of District 6, the north, kind of northwest, an area northwest of Greenwood and north of Crown Hill. And then District 6, which is Dan Strauss's district, in a Ballard, Crown Hill, Wallingford, et cetera, it gets that western chunk of Magnolia that District 7 gives up. Andrew Lewis's District 7, in addition to losing that western half of Magnolia, its southern boundary shifts northward, and District 7 then loses Pioneer Square to District 1, Lisa Herbold's district. So that's kind of how the boundaries shift. And if we want to think about how this is going to affect the next city council elections, which are coming up in 2023, Lisa Herbold may find that she has a better financed, more conservative opponent now that her district includes Soto, Georgetown, and Pioneer Square, which all have pretty vibrant business districts. Sawant may have lost a pretty important chunk of her supporters to District 2 at this point. It'll be interesting to see. And Andrew Lewis may find it a little bit easier to get reelected without the single family neighborhood of Western Magnolia.
Now, Sawant lives in Judkins Park. Is that in District 2 now or District 3?
I don't know. I think Tammy, it depends on if she's north or south of I-90. If she's south of I-90, she'd be in Tammy Morales' district.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if she is.
Hopefully she
doesn't have to move.
Yeah, if she's north of I-90, she's okay, because I think that's pretty much the boundary. Okay. Personally, I don't keep track of where the city council members live, but if you do, you might know that off the top of your head.
Well, I visited there once about 6 years ago, so I don't remember exactly where it was, but I know it was Judkins Park.
Yeah, okay. So the Redistricting Commission is still taking public comment on the revised draft. But they're not expected to make any more changes, really. And they've set a deadline to vote on a final map by Tuesday, November 8th, which also happens to be Election Day. The commission has a deadline to meet to file a final version of the new district map with the Seattle City Clerk by November 14th, and then they have to submit it to the King County Auditor by November 15th. So that's the timeline.
All right. Moving on then to national news, but sticking with elections.
Yeah. If, like me, you're kind of nervous about whether the Republicans are going to take control of the U.S. Senate, because, of course, they only need to pick up one seat, then there are some Senate races you may want to watch on Tuesday night to see how they're going. I looked at the recent polls to find the closest Senate races, and there are seven of them that are really close in the polls right now. In Pennsylvania, recent polls are showing that the lead that Democrat John Fetterman had in this race has eroded since his debate with Republican Mehmet Oz. In spite of the fact that Fetterman is the lieutenant governor and has political experience, which Oz lacks, his verbal performance in the debate made a lot of people doubt his abilities because of the stroke he had this summer.
Yeah, and of course, Oz is basically a celebrity candidate.
Yeah.
There's no qualifications for Senate.
Yeah, and of course, there's a lot of discrimination against disabled folks that stems, I think, from a profound lack of knowledge about the lives of folks with disabilities and what does and doesn't affect their cognitive skills. But I think it's worth noting that Oz's cognitive skills are sometimes in question. And, you know, he's never had a stroke that we know of.
He's just not very bright.
Yeah, and there are several.
To be blunt about it.
Yeah, and there are several Republicans who sometimes you have questions about their cognitive skills. I know I certainly do.
Yeah, Herschel Walker in Georgia.
Oh, yeah. Mind. And that's number two on my list of races to watch is Georgia. The Democrat Raphael Warnock has also seen his slim lead over Herschel Walker evaporate, in spite of the fact that Walker has been the center of several controversies. First, he was caught claiming educational and occupational experience that he didn't have, kind of similar to Joe Kent, right? Including experience with law enforcement and a bogus degree from the University of Georgia that he didn't have. After saying he was committed to family values that included condemning abortion and absentee fathers, Walker was outed as both an absentee father himself and a person who has helped his partners pay for abortions in the past.
And he supports banning abortions with no exceptions.
Yes,
he's an
I know.
Absolutist on that.
Oh yeah, and there are new allegations that seem to be arising about every other week that he's helped yet another one of his former partners get an abortion.
And those former partners keep producing receipts. It's the damnedest thing.
Oh yeah, and also he's been accused of stalking and domestic violence against a number of women, including his ex-wife, who had to take out a protective order against him. Walker's response to all of these allegations is that he just doesn't remember them because, and get this, he has dissociative identity disorder, which can include memory loss. Yeah, I want to point out, in case you're not familiar.
Why would you hire that person to represent you in the Senate?
Yes, in case you're not familiar with that diagnosis, that's used to be called multiple personality disorder. And I think it should be a disqualification for office, especially if, especially when it involves memory loss. And he's, I think, another Republican candidate with some very, very serious cognitive issues. And of course, very popular.
They don't need to be very smart because they'll just do whatever Donald Trump tells them to do.
Yeah. And, you know, he's very popular because he's a former football player, but no one is asking if his cognitive issues might be related to the fact that he was a former football player.
Yeah.
And I think they should be.
Or spent about 20 years making a living getting concussions.
Exactly. So, the third race to watch on Tuesday is Nevada, with incumbent Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto, the first Latinx elected to the Senate. She's facing a challenge from Republican Adam Laxalt, the co-chair of the Donald Trump 2020 reelection campaign,
he's a piece of work.
Oh yeah, he still thinks the 2020 election was rigged, naturally. Masto won her first election in 2016 by a slim 2 percentage points, and the polls this year are showing that she's in a virtual tie with Laxalt. Laxalt, of course, was embroiled in the scandal around Lev Parnas and Iger Fruman's illegal campaign contributions. Laxalt sought and accepted illegal contributions from them. Both Trump and Donald Trump Jr., of course, have been stumping for him in Nevada, and they see this as a swing state for them in 2024 when Trump runs again for president, which he's expected to announce shortly after
next week. Yeah.
Election Day next week.
Yep.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about that next week.
Yeah. Number four on the list of races to watch is Wisconsin. There's another vulnerable incumbent in Republican Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. Johnson is running slightly ahead of Democrat Mandela Barnes in the polls by about 2 to 3 percentage points, which means that Barnes could flip it to the Democrats.
And that's an unusual race, because in most of these races, the Republicans have been gaining ground in recent weeks. In that race, Barnes has been closing the gap.
Yeah.
So the Republican is actually vulnerable.
Barnes was running neck and neck with Johnson all throughout the summer. But I think Johnson was able to finally open up a tiny lead because of a barrage of attack ads that he's aired in the past couple of weeks. But we'll see. Barnes may close that gap again come Tuesday. So that's one to watch.
And it's worth noting that Barnes is black, mm-hmm. which would be a first for Milwaukee and Wisconsin. But Johnson has been in the thick of most of Donald Trump's Russia-related scandals. He has been a faithful parrot of Russian disinformation in really damaging ways, particularly during the pandemic. He's been awful.
Yeah, he's a piece of work. And then the fifth race to watch is in Arizona. Incumbent Democrat Mark Kelly is running slightly ahead of his Republican challenger, Blake Masters, in the polls, again by about 2 to 3%. His Trump-backed challenger, Masters, is a venture capitalist who is far more photogenic than Kelly. So this could be a very, very close matchup on Tuesday, even though Kelly is ahead.
Yeah, and Masters is younger, too. He's about 35.
Yeah,
he's a piece of work also.
Yeah, so that could flip to the Republicans, just something to kind of watch on Tuesday. And then there's Colorado. Democrat incumbent Michael Bennett is now running neck and neck with Republican Joe O'Day. Now, O'Day is not supported by Trump. He's a more middle-of-the-road Republican, and that's given him an edge, I think, in a state that usually leans towards the Democrats. So that, again, is another one to watch.
Yeah, statewide races in Colorado have been predictably Democratic for about the last four cycles because of demographic changes in the state. And we're seeing that in places like, you know, Arizona and Texas and Georgia as well. But Colorado's ahead of that curve. Nevada also has been electing Democrats recently. So the fact that that race is neck and neck.
And I think that's why Donald Trump and Don Jr. have been working really hard to get Republicans elected in Nevada, because they wanna make it a Republican state again. They don't like the fact that it's flipping to Democrats.
Yeah, and that's a losing proposition in Nevada. Has been trending Democratic because of the explosive growth of the Las Vegas area, mm-hmm. Which is heavily Democratic. The rest of the state, especially the rural parts in northern Nevada and Reno, are solidly Republican. And you have the same kind of schism in Colorado between Denver and the rest of the state. And yeah. Places like Colorado Springs and Lauren Board's district in western Colorado.
Yeah, the urban-rural divide.
Yeah, there. It's not even urban-rural, because in cities like Colorado Springs and Reno are also Republican, But the thing is, the biggest cities in the state, the Denvers and Las Vegases, are growing so much that they are changing the demographics of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And the balance of power.
Yeah. And so that brings me to the seventh race. And of course, that's here in Washington state, because the most recent polls are showing that Patty Murray is running just a couple of percentage points ahead of her Republican challenger, Tiffany Smiley. So if you were thinking of sitting out that race, don't sit it out. Murray needs your votes if the Democrats are going to retain control of the Senate.
Yeah, honestly, for all of Murray's faults, she is at least responsive to constituents. Republicans gaining control of Congress, and as you noted, Donald Trump's going to announce for 2024 probably next week, and already has that campaign fundraising apparatus set up and going. 2024 could be the last time we have competitive elections in this country, because Republicans have made it very clear that they're not interested in democracy. They're not interested in one person, one vote. They're not interested in being accountable to constituents, especially. If Trump or another Republican nominee gains the White House in 2024, I think it's going to turn really dark really fast. And we can talk about that later, but that to me is the undercurrent to this election, is trying to stem that, head that off at the pass, before it even has a chance to take root. I want to talk a little bit about some of the, radical right wing, has been in the news, the last week. Of course, this time last week we were, just digesting the assassination attempt on Nancy Pelosi by the home invasion and attack on her husband. We've learned a lot more about the suspect this week. And he basically subscribes to every right-wing conspiracy theory that is out there. It's a very scary thing, because this, again, is an example of one person taking in vicious disinformation, believing it, and deciding to act on his own to save America. He's not the only one. The FBI issued a remarkable and almost unprecedented warning on Thursday that synagogues in the state of New Jersey were all at risk from a credible threat. They updated that Friday morning, rescinded the warning, and said that they had identified the individual. They still haven't named the person. Had interviewed him at length, in which he expressed extreme ideological views. So that does seem to have been neutralized. But the fact that you can have an entire state put on watch because of the religion or the ethnicity of people is really, really frightening. There were several other major cultural anti-Semitic incidents this past week. The rapper formerly known as Kanye West, now goes by Ye, got in trouble for, global Jewish conspiracy rules the world kind of thing. As did the basketball superstar Kyrie Irving, who was in the news last year because he could only play away games for his team because New York City banned anybody from playing who hadn't been vaccinated, and he refused to get vaccinated because, scary and anti-vaxxer disinformation. These are things that are mainstreaming in the culture now, and it's very, very frightening. You've got anti-Semitism, racism, misogyny, homophobic, anti-trans. We saw another anti-trans measure take place in Florida this week. And this is all coming out of the right wing. And it's all part of the fascist movement. It's very, very frightening that this has become mainstreamed. And it has to be confronted wherever it shows up, including in candidates in Washington state. Oh yeah, and Trump's announcing this coming week. So that'll supercharge the racism and whatnot.
And meanwhile, we continue the pattern of shootings at schools and everywhere else.
Yeah, we had another school shooting last week in St. Louis at the Visual and Performing Arts High School, where a 19-year-old male former student went in and shot up the school, killed two people, then killed himself. And it was buried in the news because there was so much else going on with the elections and you know, all the rest of it. But, it's another day ending in Y, basically, in America.
All right. So, moving on then to international and Iran.
And I want to talk about Ukraine also. I forgot to put that in my notes. There were major demonstrations again in Iran last week. It marked 40 days since the death of the young woman that sparked the outrage in the first place. And that's a major milestone in Muslim culture, because 40 days marks the end of a period of grieving. This really has been a challenge unlike any other in the, 40 some year history of the theocracy in Iran. And, it's going to, you had Joe Biden on the record this week saying that he thought that the government would be overthrown, which diplomatically speaking is a, huge no-no. You're not supposed to cheerlead for that. Even though obviously the Americans have been trying to do that for years, covertly by funding dissident groups and the like. We'll see where it goes, because it's very fluid and very unpredictable. The authorities have basically been opening fire on demonstrations at this point, and people don't care. They're risking their lives to, this is a movement that is being led by young women, who don't want to wear headscarves all the time, who don't want to become second class citizens.
They're openly and violently harassed by cultural police.
Yeah, no, they are incredibly brave. They're risking death doing this. So they deserve all the support we can offer them. And then there's Ukraine, which Russia continues to bomb. Again, vicious bombing campaigns. But Russia is losing ground in the south. The important port city of Kherson, which is at the mouth of the Dnieper River in the Black Sea, they are all but withdrawing from that area. It was one of the first major cities that the Russians were able to seize when they first invaded last February. Now we're nearing the end of the year, and the war is still going, and Ukraine is making slow progress. And we're getting a lot of reports that the Russian draft that was noisily announced by Vladimir Putin a few weeks ago, they're getting a new batch of conscripts, but training them is proving to be a disaster. They're not even bothering to train them. They're just throwing them into the front lines to die. And a lot of them, of course, are deserting because they don't want to die. Or they're fleeing the country so they can avoid the draft. So Putin has got serious problems on his hands as well, and Russia and Ukraine appears to be making slow progress despite the Russian capacity to bomb wherever they want within Ukraine. They're really trying to level the country, and it's very, very sad. It's a beautiful country.
So a week and a half back, Elon Musk took over Twitter.
Oh yeah, we should talk about that. He has subsequently announced a whole bunch of layoffs, not just of senior staff, but of the people, who make Twitter work, essentially. He has eliminated the human rights division that used to try and monitor for abuses of human rights that were promulgated on Twitter. Things like the persecution of minorities in in Myanmar. You know, there's a lot of issues globally where Twitter is incredibly influential and is used politically to advance various causes. And, you know, Twitter has to keep a handle on that. But Elon Musk is deciding to ignore it. He will probably restore Donald Trump to the feature, at or before the time when Trump announces next week. But the interesting thing about this is that Twitter is losing a lot of corporate advertisers. And, you know, advertising is really the only revenue source for Twitter. So he's losing projected revenue. He's hemorrhaging projected revenue. And, you know, some of his lenders are getting worried that they'll never see their money back. We are probably witnessing in real time the collapse of a major social media platform, which that has happened before, but it's usually been because a more robust competitor comes along.
I think one of the things that's kind of interesting in that whole thing is that Musk is aware that he's losing advertisers, and he's trying to shift the revenue source for the company from advertising to getting the users themselves to pay in order to get the blue check mark. You know, this is a verified account. And it's really, and I think the users are, the Twitter users are up in arms about it, and they should be, because it's really shifting the base of revenue for the company from advertising to the backs of the users. And that's really not the model that Twitter was set up on. So I think a lot of people who have accounts and for whom those accounts are a major source of how they do business or how they promote themselves, to suddenly have to pay on a platform where they didn't have to pay is going to be really bad for them. But it's also something that might open their eyes a little bit to, gosh, you know, this is kind of how it works under capitalism, you know?
Yeah, and I think TikTok.
At any time, you could be forced to pay.
TikTok and Instagram are cackling with glee, basically. Because there are competitors out there that people, the users are shifting to.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And they're shifting away from Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different platforms now. It's not like there's just one or two. So, you know, if Twitter's not working for you, there's YouTube, there's Instagram, there's, you know, Snapchat, there's all kinds of different.
Yeah, TikTok.
There's TikTok,
all that stuff.
There's Facebook. You know, yeah.
Friendster.
Well, maybe not Friendster, but yeah. No, and there are new ones starting all the time, so.
Yeah. Including one that's in beta testing from Jack Dorsey, who's the former head of Twitter, who was forced out so that, you know, Musk could come in. He's starting a new platform. And it will probably be very similar to the old Twitter.
Yeah, so we might see Twitter go the way of MySpace. You know?
Yeah, but in the meantime, there's been multiple outlets that have been saying that Musk is going to change the open up the, you know, supposedly $8 a month option to get a check mark next to your name at the beginning of this coming week, and it's going to be creating complete chaos for people that get their information from Twitter, because it's going to open up where once people have that mark, they've already been changing their name, you know, mocking Musk by, you know, creating fake accounts, appearing to be him, though
Elon Musk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
which is not,
there's just, like I say, there's, reports that happening right during a major election, where Musk has literally in his tweets has blamed activist groups for all the friggin' losses that he's been incurring on Twitter since he took over, and that the activist groups drove the advertisers away when clearly
it's left-wing censorship.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
He wouldn't be the first multi millionaire to have delusions of grandeur and not be able to see the actual truth of the, you know, the impact of his own actions.
Yeah, but in this case, he's literally got his the Musk bros along with extremist right wing ideology that is amplifying all those messages and transferring those over to the other social media outlets that you mentioned. You know, that people are
Moving. Also,
and also right-wing.
Also keep in mind that
right-wing platforms like Telegram and Gab and WhatsApp.
Yeah. Also keep in mind that there's a cultural element involved here too that comes right out of Silicon Valley. It's this idea of the disruptor. So instead of creating a business and then growing the business, but also trying to stabilize it, you're out there trying to disrupt the industry and disrupt other businesses. But also, to a certain extent, you turn that disruption culture onto your own business after it's been operating for a while. So here's Elon Musk stepping into a well-established business, and he's using that disruptor kind of ideology to go in there and let's fire the entire management team. Let's, you know, let's start cutting staff. You know, let's change the compensation structure. Let's change the revenue structure.
Exactly.
Too much change can destabilize a company to the point where it just implodes. So we'll, you know, regardless of what, of how much they publicize what their, you know, what their goals are, on other social media.
Especially something where the number of users is basically the company's product, both for advertisers and for investors in terms of valuing the company. Yeah. And the company is now losing value because it's losing users.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it does factor into the big picture that we're all going to be looking at on Tuesday and the following week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. And again, it's an example of, you know, corporate media is not your friend in the fight against fascism.
Well, and which is why I tell everybody I can, you know, don't be getting your news from social media. Although that's where a lot of people get it anyway. I understand that. And, you know, they have friends that they trust that they like to get, you know, media links from. But I just feel like, hey, you know, there are always, you know, develop a list of those progressive news sites you like and, you know, be checking those and don't be relying on, you know, getting your news from Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and places like that.
Twitter is good for alerting you to breaking news. That's about it.
Yeah. And then you click through to the website and you check them out. Who are these people?
Yeah, exactly.
Before you believe it, pass it on.
It's credible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can find plenty of very good individuals who are great resources, who specialize in specific fields and stuff. I mean, that's what I primarily use it for.
Yeah.
You know, that's the best way of keeping tabs on their analysis of situations, you know. But you need to, you know, properly vet them ahead of time to make sure that they know what the heck they're talking about.
Yeah.
As you should be doing with us.
Yes. and I would add to that that Mike's social media is a great resource. He posts a lot of good links during the course of the week. Depending on my health, I do as well, and so does Maria. So yeah, we're around. And we've been doing this a long time. And one of the things that we offer as a show and as individuals in the show is that we've been doing this for a long time, so we can provide important context that is often missing from news accounts. You know, we can look at news accounts and say, oh yeah, that fits with this. Or that we've seen this before when that happened. You know, and you just don't get that in newsrooms anymore. It's in the lack of local news reporting especially.
Yeah, I find myself increasingly going to our original sources. So like during the elections, I'll go directly to the county or state election websites to get my news of, okay, what are the actual vote counts.
So we'll talk to you both same time next week.
Sounds good.
I'll be there.